Dr. George Dimitri, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Over the past 5 years, 51% of all FDA-approved cancer drugs have had substantial input from Dana-Farber scientists and clinical investigators. And that comes from the culture here, the very basic curiosity-driven scientists that are probing really how cancer works.
At Dana-Farber, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey there. I'm Claire Thornton, and this is Five Things. It's Sunday, April 11th. USA Today and For the Win just released the new season of our true crime podcast, The Sneak, The Disappearance of Mario Rossi. This season, the show is about the dark underbelly of NASCAR. In the 1980s, NASCAR wasn't like what it is today. Back then, engineer Mario Rossi was one of the most talented minds in the sport. He disappeared without a trace around New Year's Day in 1983. There are more theories than I can count as to why he went missing. Our reporters set out on a journey to see if some of NASCAR's original sins, including a $300 million drug smuggling ring, are what caused Rossi to vanish. Here's the season's lead reporter, Michelle Martinelli, with more.
It's very unusual. I feel like that, you know, someone disappears and there's no real answers turned up by, you know, a law enforcement investigation or private investigators or the family working on their own. And so we're investigating that. We're trying to figure out exactly what happened and how his disappearance may be connected to this $300 million international drug smuggling ring.
For the past 8 months, Michelle's team worked on the case and interviewed family members and NASCAR veterans, and all during the pandemic.
It was an emotional experience. We worked closely with the family, and that includes Mario Rossi's two children, Bill and Tina, as well as Mario's two sisters, Ginny and Bee. You know, we're very humbled that they were willing to, you know, not just accept our help in trying to find some answers for them, but, you know, they opened up about a deeply personal story and a painful one that they, you know, have struggled with for almost 4 decades.
I'm going to let you listen to the full first episode of the season right now. If you like the show, you can go find it wherever you're listening.
To begin this story, we have to go back to the year 1983. It was a couple days after the New Year, and Bill Rossi was in New York City. While Bill is 59 now, he was just 21 then. On that cold January day, Bill got a call from his family, and they told him he needed to go to his grandma's house in New Jersey. He wasn't one to question family, so he made the trek. When he arrived at his grandma's house, though, his uncle told him they needed to go for a ride. Bill was a bit disoriented. This wasn't like his family at all. Still, he wasn't one to question his uncle, so he got in the car.
That was the part I didn't quite understand, why we just didn't go to the house while we were riding, you know, riding around. And then basically he had told me, you know, that my father was killed in a plane crash.
Bill sat in shock. His father was Mario Rossi, a legendary race car owner and engine builder who we'll get to know very well this season. Sitting in his uncle's car, Bill tried to process the information. Mario was dead, at just 50 years old, having crashed his plane outside the Bahamas. In stunned silence, Bill's uncle drove him back to his grandma's house. And then things got very strange.
What happened when you walked in?
Basically, you know, I came in and they were just sitting, and part of what was going on was they were getting these calls to go to different places, like a phone booth, for instance, instead of calling the house.
Wait, explain that to me. Why did they need to go to a phone booth?
And this is part of, you know, what was going on in the beginning with the, I don't know, it was kind of like there was something suspicious about it.
The person calling was saying, you need to go get a,
yeah,
to a different
to a
phone,
phone
and then
yeah.
And then call me and then we can talk. Interesting. So even then, were you processing it, or were you thinking in that moment, like, this is weird?
Yeah, I think more or less just it was kind of odd. And then, you know, I knew my father had some stuff in Florida, you know, at his house or in storage. And I knew there was trophies and different things, and he had a gun collection and stuff. So I was going to try to get all that. And you know, I was told that I, you know, to leave it alone.
You were told? Who told you?
A woman on the telephone. I can't remember. I think it was a lady named Betty. I can't say. I can't remember the name for sure.
The Rossies had never heard of this woman, Betty. Yet here she was, telling them everything about the fate of Mario. She told Bill not to come to Florida. He couldn't collect his father's things. And she told the family they couldn't come identify the body because no one could find the wreckage. She told them that Mario Rossi was gone. Bill stood there, trying to process everything he was hearing. While he and his father had never been all that close, he could admire the man for his many accomplishments. Mario Rossi was a true pioneer in one of America's most beloved sports, NASCAR. He was by all accounts a genius, a gearhead who built engines for legends of the sport despite having no formal education in engineering. His lasting legacy, however, is most likely the safety innovations he helped design, innovations which saved countless lives. Yet he was also a man who had allegedly gotten involved with some of the most nefarious figures in NASCAR, men who would go on to be indicted in the biggest drug smuggling bust in the sport's history. Yeah, NASCAR, the squeaky clean, corporate-friendly sport, has a history that's anything but. We'll get into all that, though, because on that January day, none of it meant much to Bill Rossi. His dad was gone, and as he was gone, Bill was now the man of the house. When Bill tried to insist he come down to collect his father's things and settle the man's affairs, the woman on the phone said something else, something that would seem to change this story from a tragic accident to something far more sinister.
Again, we were trying to possibly make arrangements for me to go get my father's, you know, belongings. And, you know, she basically told me that you'd be a dead man before you got to the bottom of the stairs from the plane.
My name is Nate Scott. I'm a reporter and editor with For the Win and USA Today. Welcome to Season 3 of The Sneak. Hey everyone, Nate again. We are back for our third season of The Sneak. This season is called The Disappearance of Mario Rossi, and I've got some help this year, actually. The help comes in the form of my colleague, Michelle Martinelli, and she's here right now. Hi, Michelle.
Hey, Nate.
How are you?
I'm good.
You sound excited.
I am excited. This is such an interesting story that we seem to have stumbled on.
It is. We're going to get to that. Before we do that, though, you should say hi and introduce yourself.
Well, I'm Michelle Martinelli. I cover college football and motorsports for the Win and USA Today Sports.
You mentioned college football and motorsports. We are going to slide college football off to the side, even though you're great at covering it. But we are focusing on motorsports this season, specifically NASCAR. And you cover that series for us.
I do. Yes.
Tell me about NASCAR.
You know, it's the biggest motorsports league series, however you want to define it, in the United States. And that's largely what our audience latches onto. They like NASCAR.
Who have you interviewed in the sport?
At this point, it feels like everyone, which is not true because there are so many people.
Give me some names that I have heard of and remember that I am a NASCAR idiot.
Dale Earnhardt Jr., Danica Patrick, Jeff Gordon, Jimmy Johnson, Bubba Wallace, Chase Elliott, lots of big names all over the place.
Okay, so I have heard of those people, and I think suffice to say that you are an expert in the sport.
I think so at this point. It was a challenge initially, but a few years later after covering it, I feel like I know it pretty well.
Okay, I'm Michelle's editor, and I'm going to say that she's full of it, and she's being modest, and she's one of the best NASCAR reporters alive, and that's the end of it, and we're going to move on from there. I just want you all to understand that we have an expert in-house, a subject matter expert who is going to help me dive into this world, because I'll be the first to admit, you know, I barely know what a car engine is. So we needed Michelle. She's here. She's going to be helping us reporting all season, and we're super excited to have her. However, I have to say that the story we're telling this season wasn't actually unearthed by Michelle. It actually came from someone else. If you listen to season two of this podcast, you'll probably recognize his voice.
So I says, look, I just got my case dismissed and I'm running from the media. I didn't break any laws. I didn't do anything wrong. I'm just getting away from the media. So he says, what's your name? I said, Salvatore Gretsch.
That's Salvatore Sonny Gretsch. He was an accomplice of Jack Murphy, a.k.a. Murph the Surf, our subject in season two. Sonny was a notorious burglar in South Florida in the 60s, and he ended up serving time for a robbery he committed alongside Murphy. He's since cleaned his life up, though, and is living as a realtor and model citizen in Naples, Florida. Anyway, last season, during one of our long conversations, Sonny said something that was a bit surprising to me. He said it after I asked him what he thought about the United States prison system. Say someone says, well, Sonny, you are an example of a success story of the prison. You think you're an exception. Prison didn't set you up for success. You got lucky because...
Absolutely, I got lucky. My sister gave me a job when I got out, you know, but it didn't help because I went right back to crime. I mean, I went into smuggling, you know, and we had a NASCAR racing team. We were racing NASCAR every weekend.
I had asked Sonny an innocuous question about his life after crime, and here he was telling me about a massive drug smuggling operation in NASCAR, one that I'd never heard about.
But we were very successful. We had a lot of fun racing. NASCAR was fun. But at that time, there was probably five or six or seven guys that were racing NASCAR, that were top names, that were doing some kind of drug deals, you know, because they didn't have sponsors back then.
Sonny went on to tell me that his partners had all been busted in an FBI sting, but he'd actually gotten out of it because they never caught him on tape. I was beyond curious, but I had to keep Sonny focused on the surfing story that we were working on. Still, I made a point to write it down in my notes just so I could look it up later. A few weeks after we wrapped the second season, I did that. I went and looked it up. There it was, exactly how Sonny described. See, in 1982, a group of men working out of an auto shop in Florida were arrested for their roles in a massive marijuana smuggling operation. And a handful of the men were indeed veteran NASCAR drivers. Guys like Gary Ballou, who was arrested just 4 days after he finished 11th in the 1982 Daytona 500. He finished ahead of the likes of NASCAR legends like Darrell Waltrip, Richard Petty, and Dale Earnhardt Sr. Gary Ballou was eventually convicted of importing marijuana, possession of marijuana with intent to distribute, and conspiracy. He was sentenced to 6 years behind bars. The arrest took place on Thursday, February 18th, a day that the media at the time christened Black Thursday. When it was all said and done, there were 70 arrests made that day. And Sonny Gretsch said he knew the major players involved, the guys from the shop, and I was sort of flabbergasted by all of this. I'd heard rumblings about NASCAR's outlaw roots, but I figured that was way in the past. This was a sport with major corporate sponsors and iconic, family-friendly stars. Now I was reading about massive drug smuggling operations. Very quickly, it became clear that I didn't know NASCAR at all. So I started Googling, and it was there I stumbled upon the story of Mario Rossi and his mysterious disappearance. A disappearance that happened just months after Black Thursday. The more I read, the more I was surprised that such an unbelievable story had flown under my radar. Still, I wasn't a huge NASCAR guy. So I called Michelle, wanting to ask her a million questions about Mario Rossi. And she had never heard of him. So I told her to ask around, thinking she might call up an old crew chief or something. That wasn't going to be good enough for Michelle, however.
Hi, this is Jeff Gordon. How are you?
Yeah, she called Jeff Gordon, who's only one of the most winning NASCAR drivers of all time.
Have you ever heard of the crew chief named Mario Rossi from the 1960s and 70s?
No. You know, I'm a guy that grew up in California and followed other forms like sprint cars, dirt track racing, IndyCar, before I really started getting into NASCAR.
So no go on Jeff Gordon. Michelle kept going, though.
Hey, Michelle, it's Jimmy.
That's seven-time NASCAR Cup champion Jimmy Johnson.
But I was wondering if you had ever heard of a crew chief engineer named Mario Rossi from the 60s and 70s?
Not sure if I have.
We were 0 for 2. Next up, she tried Joey Logano.
Have you ever heard of a crew chief engineer named Mario Rossi from the 1960s and 70s?
Mm-mm.
No?
No.
And 2020 NASCAR Cup Series champion Chase Elliott.
His name was Mario Rossi. You ever heard of him?
I have not, no. Sorry.
And Clint Bowyer.
No.
Okay.
I've heard Alexander Rossi.
Yeah, no, not the same guy.
We thought we were heading for a total failure. But then we got lucky.
Have you ever heard of an engineer and crew chief named Mario Rossi from the 60s and 70s?
Yes.
That's the voice of Brad Keselowski, who's a Team Penske driver who was the 2012 NASCAR Cup Series champion.
What do you know?
He went missing and no one has seen him for a long, long time.
Finally, we had actually found someone who had heard of Mario Rossi. Keselowski at first floated out a few theories about the disappearance, stuff that we'll get into later in the show. But what's funny about this call is what happened at the end. After Michelle and Brad talked about Mario briefly, they changed the subject, then talked about other stuff for a good 5 minutes. But as they were getting set to hang up, Keselowski clearly still had it on his mind.
Those are all the questions that I have. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
No problem.
I really appreciate it.
Do you know something about Mario Rossi? Because I really want to know. I feel like this should be on Unsolved Mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
He had a lot of innovations, but then also just disappeared for no reason whatsoever.
So yeah, most of today's drivers didn't know about Mario Rossi. But Keselowski's enthusiasm showed us that the story hadn't been lost to time. It was still whispered about in garages. A spook story shared among old-timers in the sport. The strange tale of Mario Rossi. For those who knew about it, the story still had a hold on their imaginations. And now we were hooked. So we went back to the Rossi family with even more questions. We wanted to know everything.
I would just like to start by asking you to introduce yourself.
I'm Tina Rossi Grimes, Mario Rossi's daughter. I live in Lexington, South Carolina.
That's Tina, Bill's younger sister. She's a very important person to know in all this. Though, like with Bill, Tina's relationship with her father was a bit strained. She told us that her children growing up never even knew about Mario or his disappearance.
They didn't need to know. They never met him. You know, I was pregnant with my second child. He was missing. He never met any of my children.
What made you want to tell them about your real father?
I didn't. My brother's boys did. Yeah, they, you know, cousins talking, chatting. That's how it happened.
While her older brother Bill seems to wear a permanent poker face, always deciding whether or not you're someone he can trust, Tina doesn't mind showing you her cards. And in a story full of cryptic dead ends and secrecy, Tina's openness is more than refreshing. It's a lifeline. Tina gamely shared sensitive details with us about her family, about her struggles to connect with Mario, and her decision not to tell her kids about their missing granddad, a decision she made to protect them from the agonizing unknown she'd wrestled with for years. In light of all that pain, it's no wonder that Tina eventually stopped trying to solve the mystery of what happened to her dad. There never seemed to be any answers. Only misery. But over time, that changed. She found herself unable to forget the strange circumstances of Mario's disappearance. So she started digging. She did it for years, which turned to decades. Until one day, Michelle and I called her up and offered to help. Perhaps with nowhere else to turn, the Rossis accepted. After 38 years of looking, we were the family's Hail Mary, a last-ditch effort to find the truth of what happened. So, with their approval, we got to work. And to start, we went to the man who knows more about NASCAR than just about anybody alive.
All right, I'm going to start by asking you to introduce yourself.
Mike Hembry. I'm a longtime NASCAR / auto racing reporter, writer. Started back in 1975.
Mike Hembry's a legendary NASCAR reporter who's covered the sport for the Spartanburg Herald Journal, the Greenville News, Auto Week, Speed Channel, NASCAR Scene, and, for a while, with us at USA Today.
Can you tell us where we are right now?
We're at Cowpens National Battlefield, which is one of the two or three turning points, historians say, in the Revolutionary War.
Cowpens National Battlefield is in Gaffney, South Carolina. Mike had us meet him there at a picnic area surrounded by a dense forest. It's peaceful, serene, and quiet, aside from a few crows nearby who kept squawking. Anyway, we were excited to talk with Mike because Mike knows just about everything there is to know about NASCAR. We were about to hear Kane when he was telling us about Spartanburg, South Carolina, and the city's contributions to the sport of NASCAR, which led us to ask about Mario Rossi.
You said they were innovative, especially with safety things. Do you happen to know how Mario Rossi tied into any of that?
He was involved, if he was not the key person, in developing a better safety harness. Rossi was known for responding to accidents, I guess, as well as anybody in the sport.
Hembree told us that Rossi actually started as a driver who had competed in a few NASCAR races in the 50s. By the time Hembree got onto the scene, Rossi had remade himself into one of the great mechanics and crew chiefs in the sport. And Rossi's mentor was the greatest of them all, a man delightfully named Smokey Unick.
For most mechanics who have come through the sport over the years, Smokey Unick was the guy. At Indianapolis, Smokey Unick was essentially a god. I mean, he wandered around in his white uniform with the Stetson hat, which was greasy from all the years.
Smokey Unick was a World War II veteran who flew over 50 missions in a B-17 Flying Fortress. He then moved to Daytona Beach and opened up an auto shop, which was literally called Smokey's Best Damn Garage in Town. After that, he became the most legendary mechanic and engine builder in NASCAR history. And Rossi was one of his prized protégés.
There are innovators, and there are innovators who look at what somebody else has done and copy it, you know, and maybe improve it a little. It's hard to improve on stuff that Smokey did.
Where do you think Mario Rossi fell in that line between innovator and copycat innovator?
I think he was an innovator.
Rossi was credited with a lot of innovations, but his contributions on the safety front are what stand out. Specifically, Rossi was credited with designing a better safety harness to protect drivers. You're about to hear me talking to another one of our producers, Pat Shanahan, who was there when we were interviewing Mike.
Pat, you had a question?
I was just going to ask a similar thing about whether these Rossi innovations were responsible for saving anybody's life.
Yes, they had to be. I mean, there were many more major collisions back in those days, and the fact that what he did helped encapsulate the entire front of the driver's body to a bigger degree had to have that impact.
If what Mike Hembree was saying was true, Mike Hembree isn't one to lie. Mario Rossi should have been recognized as a legend of the sport. A legend who had mysteriously vanished just after New Year's 1983. And a man who was then, apparently, all but forgotten. It's a bit of a cliche in NASCAR that it's a sport of fathers and sons.
Some people thought you could never get into the sport if you didn't have a father or a cousin or a brother already in it.
That's Mike Hembree again. I just told him how I was struck by how often I was seeing the same last names while I was researching this story. It was all over NASCAR. Richard Petty and Kyle Petty, Dale Earnhardt Sr. and Earnhardt Jr., on and on.
Particularly in the 50s, 60s, 70s, families would go to the track with the driver, you know. And the sons in particular would play in the infield when they were 6, 8, 10. But they were always at the track, so they just picked it up.
As Mike described how the sport grew and was passed down from fathers to sons, I couldn't help but think of my conversation with Bill Rossi and how Bill's dream of entering the same sport as his dad, well, it hadn't quite worked out.
Let's talk about Mario the man. For someone who's never met him, how would you describe him just as like a guy?
Yeah, that's kind of hard to do because I didn't get to really know my dad, you know, like most people would. You know, his routine was he'd get up, go to work, come home for dinner, go back to work, go to a track. So, I mean, you know, we spent some time at the track with our dad, but, you know, nowhere near, you know, the amount of time that I wished I could have spent with my father.
We asked Bill multiple times about memories he had of his father, and he struggled to come up with any. He actually got apologetic because he just didn't have the memories. memories he so clearly wanted to have.
It just kind of tears me up that I can't answer it, you know, because I didn't have that. You know, we talked about photographs, family pictures, you know, they're just not there. You know, it wasn't the Ozzie and Harriet normal kind of family. You know, Dad was a racing guy, you know, and racing was his life.
Tina told us similar things about her father. She had even fewer memories of her dad before her parents split. And once they split, she didn't see Mario often.
We never were completely together. He was in one state or we were in a different state. And, you know, so it was not a normal family relationship, we'll have to call it.
After he was gone, the two Rossi kids watched as other NASCAR dads passed the family's racing traditions down to their kids. Kids who would go on to become drivers, crew chiefs, and team owners themselves. Having seen that, they now can't help but wonder what could have been.
I do sometimes kind of hate that he chose, that he couldn't make the balance between, you know, racing and a family. You know, I mean, I think a lot of times I sit back and where would I be today? You know, I mean, I've thought about that. Would I have been in racing? You know, had my dad stayed here and I've been more a part of what he was doing, you know, maybe I would own a team today, or maybe I'd have been a driver today.
Mario Rossi's disappearance has haunted his family. They have spent decades now wondering what actually happened to him, wondering why they got those mysterious phone calls after his disappearance, wondering if they could ever find his body, finally get answers. But they were also left wondering what might have happened to their lives had he stuck around. Maybe he would have become more of a family man. Maybe he would have welcomed his son into his world more, and Bill would now be working in NASCAR, not just someone who attends the odd race and memorabilia convention. Maybe Bill's life, maybe all the Rossi's lives, would be different. And as I started my investigation, I had gotten emotionally invested as well. I wanted to help this family. And at the start, I felt I could. I was good at this, after all. I told the Rossis I'd help them find out what happened. Of course, I didn't know then what I know now. I didn't know that this case would confuse and enrage me for months on end. I didn't foresee the hours and hours and hours of interviews, each one more confusing than the last. I didn't see the dead ends, nor the lies that people would tell me, nor how the case would worm its way into our brains such that everyone on staff began to actually dream about Mario Rossi. All that was to come. If I had known, I wouldn't have been so confident. If I had known, maybe I would have simply walked away. Mario Rossi had been a mystery to us. But as we talked to his kids and Mike Hembree and read just about everything we could find out there, we learned quite a bit about the man. We learned that Rossi was brilliant, that he was consumed by racing. And we learned that he was a man with a rebellious streak, a guy who got into plenty of scraps during his time in racing. He didn't seem to care who he mixed it up with either, once legendarily going head-to-head with the former CEO of NASCAR at the Daytona 500. Was that rebellious streak part of his undoing? We'd have to investigate more, but looking at Rossi's career, one thing in particular caught our eye. We were on a website called racingreference.info, which collects stats and information from pretty much every race in NASCAR history. We were looking at what they said was the final race Rossi ever served as a crew chief for in NASCAR. The year was 1979, and the website said that for one race, Rossi had served as the crew chief for a man named Gary Ballou. The same Gary Ballou who was arrested in a massive drug sting 3 years later. The one that Sonny Gretch first told me about, which we talked about earlier this episode. It was a strange connection, to be sure. So I asked Mario's son Bill about Gary Ballou.
Gary, I don't know, he seems to really clam up for the most part. And he was the closest guy, you know, with Dad at that time. Every time we've tried to contact him, asked him things. He told me some things early on when he was still under house arrest, but he couldn't tell me much because he was, you know, he said, we can't talk on the phone because they might be listening.
I asked Bill who they were, the people who might be listening. He didn't have an answer.
After that, he moved to Chicago, and I really haven't been able to talk to him since.
Several years after Mario Rossi's disappearance, his daughter Tina went on a vacation to the Bahamas. It was really just supposed to be a getaway for her and her husband, but while they were there, they figured they'd poke around and see if they could find out anything about the plane crash her father had been in.
Well, we went to, my husband and I went to the consulate, you know, basically explaining the situation, and they got back to me and said there was no plane crash.
The Bahamas had no record of a plane crash. Perplexed, Tina returned to the States, where the family discovered yet another bombshell. See, around this time, the family learned that Mario had taken out a life insurance policy before his disappearance. When they tried to file a claim, they said that the insurance company, Prudential, told them they needed more information.
Because, you know, they're not going to pay out anything until they investigate. And they came back and said that plane was bought and sold twice.
The plane, a single-prop 1979 Cessna, had been sold after Mario Rossi had supposedly died in a crash in it. And then it had been sold again. This season of The Sneak, we'll go searching for that plane. We'll keep digging into the wild history of NASCAR and learn more about an apparent drug smuggling ring that, almost unbelievably, had infiltrated the sport in the early 1980s. And we'll explore the possibility, one Bill Rossi himself suggested to us, that his father is actually still alive.
Based on what people have told me over the years, you have to think that, you know, he didn't die in 1983. You know, he wasn't killed in that plane crash. It didn't happen.
You can go listen to the next episode of The Sneak, The Disappearance of Mario Rossi, right now. Six more episodes are coming out in the next month and a half. A new episode will be released every Thursday. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show and write a review on Apple Podcasts. Taylor Wilson will be back tomorrow morning with 5 things you need to know for Monday. Thanks for listening. I'm Claire Thornton. See you next Sunday. Until then, keep up with me on Twitter. I'm at Claire_THORNTO.
Dr. George Dimitri, medical oncologist, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute.
Over the past 5 years, 51% of all FDA-approved cancer drugs have had substantial input from Dana-Farber scientists and clinical investigators. And that comes from the culture here, the very basic curiosity-driven scientists that are probing really how cancer works, and then the expert clinicians that interact with patients and families every day. It's not easy to have input at a substantive level to new drugs that are safe and effective at treating cancer. So our whole mantra has always been to try to minimize risks to patients and yet try to maximize the opportunity of finding how effective a new treatment could be. And that means understanding cancer really, really deeply.
At Dana-Farber, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.